Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Risky Business. I'm Patrick Gray. Our podcast is hosted by Vigabyte Virtual Hosting and is sponsored this week by Sophos. Now, without our sponsors, we don't have a show. And as you'll hear, Sophos is a company with some extremely solid talent here in Australia. Sean Richmond, who works for Sophos in Sydney, will be along in this week's sponsor interview to discuss the PDF format and why PDF readers like Acrobat Reader have been pretty bug-prone lately. That's coming up later. This week's feature interview is pretty kick-ass, actually. We've got an interview with security mega-legend Mark Dowd. We'll be chatting to him about his entry in Google's native client security competition. It's very interesting stuff that could really have implications for your job in a few years. But first up, it's time for a look at the week's headlines, and it's been a big news week. And this week we're joined by, as usual, he's turning into our regular, freelance security consultant and Risky.biz columnist Adam Metalstorm Boileau. And Adam, in this first story, we've seen some news in the USA that MRI machines and medical machines infected by Conficker had to stay infected for 90 days because regulations prevented staff from being able to fix them. Is this just red tape gone mad?
Yeah, this it's a kind of a troublesome sort of thing, really, because in the medical environment, hospital environment, you do kind of have to have a higher standard of change control than you would in just a regular business. I mean, these were systems that were being used to view, MRI results and, all sorts of other kind of, fairly important stuff. And to some extent, I feel kind of good that there was a policy that you can't just go around changing these things ad hoc. I mean, on the other hand, obviously being infected with a virus is a pretty, exceptional circumstance. But it's a difficult thing, right? We have to, have this tension between having good change management, and then having to respond to unusual circumstances like that. I suppose the obvious thing to say is these systems should not be connected to any sort of internet connected networks, so they shouldn't get infected in the first place. But, in the year 2009, that's probably a bit unrealistic to expect. The utility of networks is such that it's just, they're going to get connected, right? We probably just ought to accept that and then try and cope with the consequences. But it's a tough call. I wouldn't want to have to be the network admin guys or hospital dealing with this stuff because, you're pulled in both directions. And what do you do?
Yeah, well, the other thing about this one, mate, is that, if I'm operating an MRI, I'd obviously want to have that on the network. I mean, I don't know if this is how it works, but I can imagine the doctor would, or the guy who does the MRI scan might take some sort of set of images and then send them via some sort of networking protocol, like IP, down the hall to the doctor who actually has to look at them. I mean, I can imagine that, networking this sort of machinery makes perfect sense. And we've got a quote in here from some guy, Rodney Joff, who's one of the founders of the Conficker Working Group, saying these systems should never have been connected to the internet. Well, sorry, mate, you might find that it's really worthwhile having these systems connected to the internet.
Yeah, I mean, I think the utility of having them connected is probably more important
than the risk of having them knocked over every now and then.
Yeah, but I think the best thing we can do is have a good response plan so that we can deal with these systems getting owned. We just have to accept that, yes, they're going to get owned occasionally, and we need to be able to detect that and respond to it more effectively. Have a procedure in place for, pulling replacement machines out, setting up a separate network that is isolated in the interim while we clean it up. That seems like a better thing to do rather than allow ad hoc changes on production medical equipment or expect that they're not going to be connected and therefore don't need to be patched.
So what you're saying is we don't need to discard the red tape, we just need to make it better.
Well, I think it just needs to accept the realities of the situation that it's in. Networking is ubiquitous and necessary, and network worms are a side effect of that, and we just need to be able to cope with that sort of thing happening.
Excellent. On to our next story, and Twitter. They've been, getting owned left, right and centre lately, and it's happened again.
Yeah, well, big surprise there. I mean, you kind of got to feel sorry for them. I mean, they scale up so quickly that they don't, I'm sure they don't really have the time to stop and think about what they're doing much. On the other hand, right, having their admin password be happiness, not so cool.
No. Oh, is that what happened in this case, was it?
Yeah, that was the previous one. This one, I think, was someone's Yahoo Mail account, like some staff member's Yahoo Mail account got compromised, and then they used the password reset, I believe, to get his password reset and gain access to his account.
So they might want to think about two-factor authentication for their staff.
Well, yeah. And I think the thing that's instructive about this is just because you can scale up your technology doesn't mean you can scale up your staff and your procedures.
Mm.
You can bung stuff on Amazon EC2 and go from 2 servers to, 500 servers in, 15 minutes if you want, right? It's very easy to scale up and up with technology, but having the administrative procedures and having your staff understand the implications of being all of a sudden, a global, phenomenon, that takes a bit longer.
Yeah, well, I think in the early days, which were, let's face it, not that long ago, they had massive problems when everyone was signing up. The service would often fall over, hence the now infamous fail whale, when users would go to Twitter and just see the picture of, very cute picture, actually, wasn't it? You've seen the fail whale, have you?
Yeah, I'm familiar with the fail whale.
Yeah, the fail whale is awesome. And, if you're gonna deny service, it's way better than some sort of, internal server error 500. It's the way to fail is with the fail whale. But, yeah, they had all sorts of problems scaling up, and looks like now they're finally going to have to get around to dealing with the security problem. But it really does sound like, both times the compromises have happened due to weak authentication. So, really, just a simple two-factor rollout would probably improve things immeasurably. And that way, Ashton Kutcher and Britney Spears can be left to tweet in peace.
Actually, one of the guys over here rage quit Twitter because it's so insecure. He got pissed off with being able to do basic auth to his Twitter account and people sniffing his basic auth creds on the gateway.
Oh, do they do clear text auth? No, that's through some sort of API, isn't it? I think the actual, the web stuff's all through SSL, but I think if you're using a Twitter application, it's really dodgy.
Yes, it just uses, you can optionally just use HTTP basic auth. And I saw someone running dsniff on their corporate gateway and grabbing Twitter creds as they went past by the bunchful.
Nice. You could have a lot of fun with that.
You certainly can, especially when, one Twitter bot starts professing its love for another Twitter bot.
Well, I was going to say, or it's a great time to announce one Twitter bot's sudden declared homosexuality or something like that. Could be heaps of fun.
Yes, there's many, many amusing and humorous afternoons to be had.
That is true. Now, to a bit of lols of the week, there's a couple of lols stories coming up in this week's bulletin, but MI6 in the UK had to scratch a major undercover operation when one of their Brightspark agents left a USB stick containing very sensitive information in their purse on a bus, I think it was.
Yeah, this is just so much fail. I mean, it's fail on so many different levels that you, in the end, you end up just laughing. I mean, I'm glad my tax dollars aren't paying for that kind of incompetence, or at least maybe the New Zealand government keep it under wraps a bit better.
Yeah, I think they're probably just more secretive. We had a very similar situation with some military files on a dead soldier winding up left in a Qantas Club lounge and then promptly leaked to the press. That was last year or the year before. So this stuff happens, and I think what's really interesting, Windows 7 is seeking to address this by having what they call BitLocker Portable, which is their extending BitLocker onto their full disk encryption onto mobile storage devices, which I think is long overdue. I think it's a really good idea.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be a great selling point for them too when they're looking to say, hey, you don't need to use XP anymore.
Well, yeah, any excuse, right?
Yeah, but I mean, it seems like an actual legitimate one, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, it does. I mean, and I saw, my notes for this story had "Learn to Crypt" written in big letters next to this this article.
Yeah, well, that's the thing with Windows 7, you sort of won't have to learn to crypt. Do you know what I mean? It's just going to be one of those things where people, because they can see the little click box where they go "encrypt my shiz." So that'll be good. I'm hoping that's going to take care of this sort of stuff. But anyway.
Yeah, we hope.
Speaking of Windows. Oh, go on.
I was going to, the depths of government competence, they run pretty deep.
They do. They could probably find a way to screw it up anyway. In this next piece that comes to us via wired.com, Microsoft has apparently created a more secure pre-locked down version of Windows that it is selling to the Air Force, which, of course, begs the question, why isn't this the version they're selling to the public?
Well, it's the classic trade-off between functionality and security. I mean, I think the story is really good. I'm glad to see that the Air Force is using their purchasing power to kind of bully the vendors into doing something. And I'm sure Microsoft, were quite happy to work on a more secure version of Windows because it's a PR win for them in the sense that, at least they're attempting to do something constructive. On the other hand, of course, it makes us feel like, well, why the hell don't we get a secure copy of Windows to start with? But, in the end, auto run and all those sort of things are there to make it easy for consumers. And if we insist on having one operating system that is as good for the Air Force as it is for, you know, grandma at home, then, you know, we have to find some compromise between functionality and security.
All right. Hey, this next piece, look, this was a great one for risky.biz because we spotted a blog post that no one was really paying much attention to. And we wrote a news story based on it, and it went sort of burko, which was great. We got our first link love from news.com. Our first, you know, really sort of significant scoop, which is McAfee. Oh, the lols, McAfee. Can you please explain why we're laughing at McAfee?
So apparently McAfee's, what was it, PCI app certification thing, that's like the, what do they call it, the McAfee safe certification seal that they put on your website. Anyway, so the system that manages that apparently was vulnerable to some fairly trivial web app bug, I believe cross-site request forgery.
This is the scanner that scans other people's website. It's the web interface to the scanner that scans your website so that you get to wear the little McAfee certified secure seal.
And yes, vulnerable to bog standard OS top 10 web app bug. Oh my, what a lot of fail.
Shame, shame, shame.
Exactly, right? And honestly, you could not be nasty enough to them in your article. They deserve so much fail. I mean, like, honestly, my pile of my notes here next to this article, it says fail, epic fail, and has a little picture of a steaming dog turd.
You actually drew a little picture of a dog turd on that one.
I drew a picture of a dog turd. Man, McAfee, seriously, shame. Shame on you guys.
Now, look, for those who are interested, though, I actually had the guy who found these bugs on Risky Business 2 yesterday. His name's Mike Bailey, but interestingly enough, he reckons that there are these bugs in all of the scanning services online. It's not just McAfee.
Well, yeah, I would not be surprised at all. And they really, yes, they should eat their own dog food. But it's... Yeah. Yeah, someone needs to do a, you know, month of security, managed security tool website bugs.
Yeah, well, I think that's what he's, I mean, I think he's going to have a whole swag of them that he's going to pop out next week. So watch this space. But it might not have been fair necessarily just to single out McAfee when we should have been spanking the broader PCI scanning industry. Because really, these are the guys who are saying, you know, we will check your web apps to tell you whether or not they are secure. And, you know, they, I mean, they're not, it's not like they had remote compromise bugs or anything like that in their system, right? So it's not the end of the world. And CSRF bugs and cross-site scripting bugs are fairly easy to, you know, they're easy mistakes to make, I guess.
But that's not the point, right? The point is that if you've got them, it means you didn't get a pen test, because they are easy to find and easy to fix, right? They are the classic low-hanging fruit. And if they're there, it's because no one looked for low-hanging fruit. And what does that say about the fruit that hangs a little high, you know?
The high-hanging fruit. You don't really hear a lot about the high-hanging fruit, do you, Adam?
I'm all about the fruit, man.
Yeah, yeah, and lovely extension of the fruit analogy. That was quite brilliant. But no, I'm with you, man. I'm with you. And look, anyone who's interested can head over to risky.biz and have a look in our news and opinion section. We've got some stuff in there, and also hear directly from the guy who actually found those bugs in the Risky Business 2 podcast. Now,
did McAfee offer up any comment to your article? Did you contact them?
Look, I did. They couldn't initially. The funny thing is, I'd promised McAfee Australia that I would run with their response the next day. You know, I was hoping for some really good response. And, you know, then all of a sudden the story went global. It was on news.com. It was on the Register, all of that. And they all had their response. So I wrote and said, where's my response? How come everyone's got it and I don't? And I kind of, you know, was the one who first wrote this up as a news yarn. And the statement is hilarious. It's McAfee is aware of public reports of website vulnerabilities. We are working to remediate these issues with the highest urgency. These vulnerabilities did not expose any McAfee corporate or customer information. Well, to that I would ask, how would you know that if someone actually successfully exploited the CSRF? Additionally, we have not seen any malicious exploitation of the vulnerability. Just because you didn't see it doesn't mean it didn't happen,
That's
is what I'd say to that.
Crock.
Yeah,
such
but it's, dude, it's the boilerplate response. Every time you go to a security company, software company, doesn't matter. As a journalist, you go, you ask for an interview, and they take the little template out of the filing cabinet, and they give it, and they sign it, and away it goes. So, you know, and they even, unusually here, had a bit of a dig. We encourage security researchers to follow responsible disclosure guidelines and not to publicly release vulnerability information until after a fix is available. Well, in Mike Bailey's case, he did actually notify them and wait for a fix. But in the case of the cross-site scripting bugs, which could be used in certain types of phishing attacks, yeah, those guys just put it straight up. I guess they didn't really have much enough sympathy. They weren't feeling the love for McAfee, but you know, that's the way it rolls in the media, bro.
Well, you know, if they can't ask for responsible disclosure and then give you fluff, you know, boilerplate PR responses, you don't get to have both. They can piss off.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, I think it's also a case that the senior people who are charged with responding to the media aren't necessarily the people who truly understand the issue. And that's one of the challenges that I've faced, you know, for the last 7 years reporting on information security. In this next piece, someone has pwned, according to a report on WikiLeaks, a Virginian patient record system, and have 8 million patient records. And they put it, they defaced the site and said, you know, we pwned your shit. We deleted your backups. You know, we've encrypted, we're ransoming your stuff. Give me $10 million and email me at, I think it was something like, you know, hackingforprofit@yahoo.com or something. Do you reckon this could be legit, or do you think it's a bit of a wind up?
Well, see, it's kind of hard to tell. I mean, if it is legit, it's a pretty ballsy, you know, pretty ballsy move. I mean, I can't imagine that the FBI are going to be particularly amused about, you know, patient records being held for hostage. I wouldn't want to be the guy who's trying to get that $10 million out, out into the real world to use for profit on the off chance they actually pay it. But, I guess, you know, if it's for real, then, you know, ballsy, I suppose.
Yeah, and kind of evil, too. I mean, this is...
Well, yeah.
This would be the worst type of cybercrime, which is, you know, really taking someone's medical records and then ransoming the government, you know, like saying, you got to pay me to get it back. I mean, that's just pretty woeful. Now, while I haven't seen a statement that's come from Virginia's Department of Health or, you know, any related entity, someone actually did tell the Washington Post that a criminal from the Virginia's Department of Health told the Washington Post that a criminal investigation is underway. Now, that and the FBI, of course, didn't say anything. Now, that could mean anything. It could mean that it was just a defacement. It could mean, I don't know. But you're right. It's extraordinarily ballsy if it turns out to be legit. And if it's not legit, then it's a really evil wind-up. Because you can imagine there's a lot of people who would be feeling very insecure about their health records being in someone else's hands.
I mean, I suppose, you'd think if it was for real that you wouldn't make such a big splash out of it. Like, if you actually just wanted the money, there will be no need to deface the front of the site unless you specifically needed to apply, you know, public, media pressure to get the money out of it. I mean, you would think you would at least first attempt to do it a bit more quietly so they can save some space.
Extortion and blackmail are best done quietly.
Yeah.
That's a long-established fact. And the email address that they used, which was something along the lines of, you know, hackingforprofit@yahoo.com. I mean, it just seems like a wind-up, but we'll see. We will see.
Well, keep an eye on the story, yes.
Yeah, but then again, you know, you think if the guy hadn't have got the database, deleted the backups, then they would have come out and said, oh, don't worry, your records are fine, but they haven't, so yeah. Who knows. Okay, Adam, mate, sensational stuff. Thank you very much for taking the time to do the news this week. We really appreciate you making the effort to do it, so cheers, mate.
Not a problem, Pat.
Adam Boileau on the line from New Zealand there. And I should point out that Adam writes a very, very funny column for us on risky.biz. It's been a couple of weeks, but if you're interested, go to the site and click on News and Opinion, and you'll find some stuff there under his Metal Storm byline. And we should have another piece from him up next week. Now, before we get to our feature interview, it's time for some housekeeping. Our sign-up drive will wind up in a couple of weeks, so please go to risky.biz and sign up for an account if you haven't already. That way you can contribute to our forums, discuss our content, and receive our newsletter. And in that newsletter, you'll get a once-weekly summary of all Risky Business podcasts and articles. In the last week alone, we've published a handful of stuff, including some written articles and two podcasts, including this one. If you're based in Australia or New Zealand, you'll automatically be entered into our sign-ups competition when you enter in all your details, and you do need to enter all your details to be eligible. Prizes include an EPC, courtesy of Kaspersky Labs, a couple of Tiki Tag RFID reader writers, and some sweet, sweet toolkits, courtesy of Microsoft. We'll be announcing the winners after AusCert. Oh, and Australian gaming laws mean it's illegal for me to offer prizes based on a game of chance, so the winners will be selected for having the coolest username as judged by my mate's three-year-old kid and my budgerigar. So there you go. Now it's a game of skill and thus compliant with the relevant regulations, I hope. Now back to the show, and it's time to speak now to Mark Dowd. Now, Mark's very well known in security research circles. He's known as a talented bug hunter and has a habit for finding ways of exploiting stuff previously thought to be trivial. His research over the last couple of years is quite staggering. We spoke to Mark about his entry in Google's native client security competition. The native client is a browser plugin that lets you run native x86 code within a browser window. A nice example Google's put on its site is of someone running Quake in a browser window. I mean, that just gives you the idea of the power of this type of plugin. So Google's running this competition that tests the plugin's security. Entrants are encouraged to find bugs and submit them to Google, and the winners receive cash prizes. Entries closed on May 5, and winners are being announced on May 15. Now, you'd think this native code thing is a terrible idea. X86 code running in your browser, this will surely be a disaster. Well, surprisingly, Mark doesn't think so. So I started off by asking him to tell us about Google's native client and the competition.
Well, basically, they released a research product called a native client, and the goal of this product is to allow native applications to be embedded on web pages and run in a secure fashion. It's a research project, and they released it late last year. To help them vet the security of it, they decided to run this security contest where they basically gave an open invitation to the security community, like, you know, try and break into this, see if you can find security vulnerabilities, see if there's a lot of them, and they could basically get an idea of how their product would fare on the internet. And I guess they're going to use the result of this to see if they want to further it or which direction they're going to go with this project.
Now, I guess the thing that I find interesting about this, besides the fact that on the relevant Google site, they've actually got a little screen cap there of someone embedding Quake in a browser, which I think is tremendously cool. But, you know, I would have thought that embedding x86 native stuff, you know, getting it to run in a browser, that's just got to be a fundamentally bad idea, right?
Well, when I read it, I thought the same thing. It sounds kind of crazy, but if you look at their architecture, they've actually gone about it in a pretty interesting way. They've basically leveraged the segmentation functionality on Intel processors to sandbox these little native applications. Basically, they utilize this to sort of sandbox your application from being able to do anything around it, and they set up this pseudo system call interface that only lets you do certain things. For example, it doesn't just let you, read and write files or do anything that, you know, might lead to privilege escalation. So they've been able to contain it in a kind of interesting way. And their hope for the project is that if this could be done securely, then you would be able to exploit features on the processor to make embedded content that, you know, utilizes like graphics optimization and stuff like that, so you can basically get better performance out of these web applications.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to ask, actually, is what sort of applications can we expect from these things in the future? I mean, you know, as cool as it is being able to embed Quake into a browser window, I don't know that it's exactly a revolutionary concept. Where do you expect that this will find its way? Will it be found in, you know, sort of enterprise software, I guess, because it's easy to deliver these sort of applications through a browser, or will it be more of a consumer thing like little games? I mean, where do you reckon it'll go?
Well, it's hard to say for sure. I don't really know what their intention is for where they're planning to take it. But, you know, they have a couple of options, which is basically the ones you said. They could make fairly graphics intensive things that are using traditional web languages such as Java and stuff. It might not have been as quick, or they might be able to use it as a framework for doing easy deployment of business-based applications across the web. So I'm not really sure. To some extent, I suspect that they just thought of the idea and put it out there to see what kind of reaction it would get and for the community to consider the possibilities of what this plugin would enable you to do.
Yeah, now it's also cross-platform, isn't it? It runs on pretty much every OS.
Yeah, it's, it's a beta product. It's a research project. So at the moment it is specific to Intel PCs, and it will run on Linux, Mac and Windows, and their browser plugin at the moment is exclusively for Firefox and Chrome.
You know, Gmail is still in beta.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, interesting. So, Mark, what was your involvement with this? Was this a research thing you did off your own bat, or was this part of your work at IBM?
Well, I kind of took an interest in it separately when I when I first saw the announcement. I became interested enough to enter the competition, and you know, IBM were happy for me to do that. So yeah, they basically let me go ahead and you know, see if I could find issues in this product and you know, compete in the competition. So it was started out of interest from me, but I guess IBM is, you know,
happy to jump on the happy to jump on the bandwagon with you.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Now, one thing I'm curious about, I mean, just earlier we mentioned that these types of, you know, this type of native code that can embed in your browser and stuff, it could be a really nice way to get business apps out to endpoints around there. So obviously, you know, the security of this plugin and of the, you know, the whole architecture and everything is obviously going to be very important to business in the future if this is something that takes off. Now, you would have been expecting to find a fair bit wrong there, but how did you actually go when you started looking at it?
Well, I did quite well. I was pretty... They actually released a white paper when the product came out that detailed the architecture of the project, and you know, they talk about the security mechanisms they have in place. And so I sort of downloaded it and started looking at the code. I was able to uncover, you know, a number of flaws, but the first iteration of implementations of this kind of thing are always going to have security problems, you know. But the ideas behind the architecture itself, I thought, were pretty decent.
So did you actually manage to get anything through to the keeper?
Yeah, yeah. I found a couple of critical vulnerabilities in it. I ended up submitting around 12 or 13 or something. And basically, they attacked the application at various different layers. Some of the flaws that I found were in the... validation of these embeddable binaries themselves, and others were targeted more specifically at the browser plugin, which basically acts as a bridge between the browser and, you know, the isolated process where your module runs.
So, Mark, I know that entries have closed, which means I guess it's safe for you to discuss with us the details of some of these vulnerabilities. What was the most interesting one that you found, and how did it work?
There was a couple of interesting ones. First, I'd like to say that all the things that we've submitted are actually publicly available anyway. You can just go to the website and look at all the issues that get submitted. It's like a bug tracking system. But I would say that there was two in particular that I was pretty happy with. One of them was to do with basically their validator goes through and ensures that only certain instructions can be executed. And they do this to make sure that essentially you can't break out of the sandbox that they create for you. And one of those instructions in particular is the jump instruction. And in certain instances of jump instructions, like basically two-byte jump instructions, they don't validate whether there's a prefix on the instruction or not. And in Intel, you can have instruction prefixes where basically you're able to, you know, modify how the instruction works to some extent. And I was able to use a what's called a 16-bit prefix to basically fool the validator into thinking that I was jumping one place in memory when I was really jumping to a different place in memory. And the reason that's important is because if they don't know where you're jumping to, it becomes a problem with their validation process, because you can jump to somewhere that they haven't validated correctly. So I was able to use that to basically execute instructions that the validator shouldn't allow, and basically break their inner sandbox. One of the other vulnerabilities that I found that I thought was pretty good was you were able to actually create a module and it would validate all the memory and all that kind of stuff, but then your module could actually unmap some of the code that you'd already validated, and you could map in new memory there that had, you know, completely unvalidated instructions and stuff like that, and basically let your new unvalidated page of memory be executed instead of the one that was originally validated. So
you basically found a way to swap out validated code for invalidated code after it had already been checked.
Yeah, that's right. So yeah, there was some problems like that that I thought were pretty interesting.
But generally speaking, these were little things that they sort of stuffed up, stuff that they didn't validate properly, little mistakes, not big mistakes. That's what I'm sort of getting here.
Yes and no. The validator is basically the core of the safety mechanism. So, yeah, they were kind of minor errors, but they allowed for a complete breach of the sandbox, and you could basically create a module to, you know, do whatever you wanted.
Yeah, minor, small mistake, big problem. I think that's what they call that. Sort of like forgetting to, you know, put fuel in the aeroplane that you're about to fly on, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So they were like minor oversights in some respects, but like when you've got a crucial part of the security model, it's very important for that to be quite solid.
So how important will the security of the applications that run on this plugin be? Can poorly written code or like really deliberately nasty code break out of the browser and start doing nasty stuff?
Well, the idea is that the applications that you develop to run will be running inside a sandbox where they can't really do anything. Having said that, I think that at this stage, the security model is simpler than what it would be if they actually put it into deployment. They talk about an inner sandbox and an outer sandbox in the literature. The inner sandbox is basically talking about where they validate the module itself to make sure that it basically can't do anything illegal. And then the outer sandbox that they talk about is basically putting ACLs on the pseudo system call interface that I talked about earlier. So, for example, maybe they could have a situation where you could have a signed executable and that would be allowed to read files from a certain directory or something like that. Now, at the moment, it doesn't have that capability, but the outer sandbox is basically alluding to possibly building in features such as that. So if they enable some applications to have extended privileges to the machine, then sure, the security of those modules is going to be important.
And it's doubtful that anyone will actually develop them properly, because that's just not what we see with enterprise software, is it?
Yeah, well, it's really hard to say. It really depends on the development environment and stuff like that. And like I said, because they haven't really fully developed out the outer sandbox stuff, it's hard to tell exactly what privileges they are going to possibly extend to applications.
But from what you're saying, I guess I'm gathering that, you know, it looks all really nice and simple now, but to make it really desirable and really practical for deployments, you know, they're going to have to actually let it do a few things that could be potentially abused.
Yeah, it's if they extend the outer sandbox and there's other stuff that potentially will become, you know, points where you'll be able to target. But the main part of the competition was sort of focusing on the product itself, which was basically evading the inner sandbox and or attacking the browser plugin and stuff like that.
Mm-mm-mm. Now, I've got to ask too, Mark, what is the actual prize for this competition?
They're actually giving away various cash prizes for the first, second, and third place. The top prize is like $8,192, then $4,096, then $2,048.
Zing!
Yeah, you know, all like in powers of two. So yeah, they're just giving away cash prizes for the contest.
And were there many entrants, or is that something that you don't know because you're sort of on the outside of the comp?
Well, all we can see is the Google Native Client Competition has an issues page where you can go and look at all the issues that have been submitted, and you can specifically look for the ones that have been submitted for the security competition. I was in a team with Ben Hawkes, and, you know, we have a bunch submitted. There seemed to be about three or four other teams that had also submitted a few vulnerabilities each. But I really kind of thought that there was going to be more teams than I saw actively submitting.
Well, I've got to say, mate, if they can get you and Ben Hawkes doing QA for them for $8,000, they're getting value for money.
Yeah, I hope so.
Now, so it sounds like really that you didn't find anything in this thing that made it fundamentally a bad idea, which I guess is, you know, is really good news for Google. But would you imagine that there needs to be a much deeper QA process before this thing's really going to be ready for mainstream adoption?
I think it could use some further scrutiny, and I'm sure that they would actually go ahead and do that before they released it. But it depends on which direction they go with adding additional features, like the stuff I was talking about earlier. If they add a lot more stuff, then obviously that's going to also need extra scrutiny, since it was never implemented during the competition. So, you know, we didn't look at it. But even the stuff we looked at, it would be good if they had additional scrutiny, you know, before it got released as a product.
Okay, Mark Dowd, thank you very much for taking some time out to discuss your entry with Risky Business, and we wish you best of luck when it comes time to judging the prizes.
All right, thank you.
Mark Dowd on the line from Sydney there in this week's feature interview. And we'll be crossing our fingers for Mark and hope he wins on the 15th. Now it's time for our sponsor interview. And this week it's Sophos who's helping to pay the bills. And Sophos, as you know, are basically an AV company, but they make a whole bunch of other stuff as well. And one of the strings they have on their bow in the Australian market is their staff. They've got some very, very, very cluey guys on there. Paul Ducklin, you would have heard on the show before, and Sean Richmond is our next guest. He also works for Sophos, so they've got a real brain power edge in this hemisphere. Now, it's a real pleasure to have Sean on the show. I've known him for a long, long time. I first got to know him at the 2600 meetings in Sydney when I lived there 6 years ago. He is a mate, and last week I asked him to brush up on the PDF format for this week's sponsor interview so he could explain to us why there are so many bugs in Acrobat Reader these days and it's such an issue. Now, it just hasn't made sense to me that PDF files could be such a problem. Surely they're a really simple format.
Well, no, actually, unfortunately not. Because what you said, it's meant to be a document format. That's absolutely correct. I don't think it was ever designed to be lightweight. It was designed to do portable document processing. And if you've looked at PostScript, which it was an Adobe thing that it grew out of, PostScript is a full Turing complete programming language. It wasn't simple, and all it was usually used for was printing graphics on printers. So it's not a simple format, and it's become more complex as people have demanded more from their documents, because it's designed specifically for electronic document transfer. So it didn't have a lot of the printing things that PostScript did. If you want to know how big it is, the actual reference for, or the last one that I saw, it's now an ISO standard, ISO 32000 from July 1st. But the last one that I could see and not have to pay for, the reference is 1,310 pages.
That seems pretty big.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, at its lowest level, or at its most simplest form, a portable document format, PDF, is got a header, it's got a what they call a tailor that says where things are in the document, and then it's effectively like a Microsoft Word document or a disk operating system. It's got sections that say, this is a reference for this container, and it contains whatever's in there. And you can embed from disassembling or dismantling PDFs, you can embed pretty much anything into a PDF. It contains or has containers which are compressed and start with a tag saying this is an object, and then can have many different objects. The underlying structure is one of a like a disk container, so it's got a reference in there, and when you do a save, it adds some more on and adds some more on, and every 10th save, it actually goes, I'll do a save as to compress the document back down to something reasonable. When you're creating something with, say, Acrobat, or I don't even know what the actual application is called, to create things using Acrobat, because I usually just output from, you know, whatever application I'm using.
Yeah, file, print, PDF.
Yes, exactly that kind of thing. So it can contain a lot of things, and JavaScript has been introduced into the PDF format to enable, like, in-reader manipulation of Acrobat forms, so that you can do things like have a form in an Acrobat document that when you put in some figures, it does the calculations to say, okay, here's the totals, or to dynamically reallocate fields based on what other selections you've got, to give it some logic within within the document itself.
That sounds like a terrific idea. What could possibly go wrong?
Well, that's exactly it. And so I've, you know, the latest problem with, or the latest few problems that we've seen with Acrobat Reader vulnerabilities have been JavaScript. And because JavaScript is a fully functional programming language with the ability to create arbitrarily sized strings. So you can actually go, instead of having to try and find a buffer overflow that is in the executable that might be, you know, 1024 bytes or something like this, you can just declare a buffer of however big you want it to be and then try and spray the heap or the stack. So the last couple seem to indicate that, you know, there could be some tightening up in the JavaScript implementation that's been used in Acrobat Reader.
Now, let me ask you, have you ever actually used a form in a PDF? Because I can't think of one. I mean, I can think of heaps of Flash applications where you enter in little forms and things like loan calculators and whatnot.
Mm.
But why on earth would you want that in a PDF?
Well, that's what I've been trying to find. And because I'm not a document creating like guru, I don't use a lot of these things. And I was looking at it and saying, well, have I ever used an Acrobat form? And I don't think I ever have.
Mm.
So, I mean, admittedly, my tendency is to use a simple reader, something like Foxit or because I use a Mac a lot, Preview. I don't generally use Adobe's Reader because it's big.
It is big, and I remember the funniest thing about Adobe Reader, I don't know if it's changed since then, but even just a couple of years ago when I was still using it, anytime you'd load up a PDF with a browser and then you'd actually close down Acrobat, it would actually hang around in memory like a bad smell, like the process would just hang around sucking down like 50 meg of page file until you went into Task Manager and told it to f*** off.
Yep, or until you killed your browser session because it's being called. And and since initial versions of Acrobat Reader, which could render something like it would print, so it's a great idea for that. You know, instead of having to, you know, you have a Word document which you can send to somebody and then they can edit it if they've got Word, and then you don't know whether that's real. PDFs, you can just, here's what it will look like if it was printed. I'm going to send it. It's immutable because almost no one's got Acrobat. I cannot remember the editor program, but
no one's got an Acrobat editor. I think is what
Acrobat Pro, Acrobat Pro is the creature. But since almost no one's got that, you can send things and just know that they're going to be just printable. People can, you know, not do much with them. They can look at the information, they can print it out, and it will show up the way you want it. That's great. But since then, we've introduced, or you know, I guess we've demanded, or Adobe have given us the ability to follow web links from within a document, the ability to do things like, you know, the table of contents, which lets you click around and say, okay, go to this section. That takes some kind of logic to say, where's the mouse clicked? Okay, we'll go and do that. There's 3D graphics capabilities. There's multimedia referencing capabilities. So there's a whole bunch of extra stuff that's gone in as the, like, use of electronic documents has flourished. We actually have a product. You send a mail, and what it does is creates an encrypted PDF and embeds whatever the original mail was, including any attachments, inside a PDF. Now, I bet you didn't know, well, I'm willing to wager a beer on it at least, that there is actually an attachments section of a PDF.
An attachments section?
Yes. So you can embed another PDF as an attachment when you've got a Acrobat Pro or something that can create a PDF. You can have an attachment. Now, only Acrobat Reader, I think maybe Foxit, but I'm not certain. But I know Acrobat Reader can display these attachments. It's a tab down on, you know, where you've got your contents and bookmarks, and then you've got an attachments tab.
So you can have a PDF within a PDF.
Absolutely. You can have a PDF within a PDF. You can have an executable within a PDF.
Oh, nice.
As an attachment. We use that too because you can, you know, have a mail gateway program. You fling it a normal mail and it just takes the whole lot, puts it into a PDF, which is encrypted and signed and immutable and complies with all of those things you were saying about needing for invoicing, and then just fires it off to whoever it was intended for. And then they open it in Acrobat Reader, and they click on the attachment, and they can save their document. Or, if you feel like it, you can actually mark things to say, you can't save out of this. You can read whatever it is, but you can't save it to disk.
So from your point of view, from an anti-malware point of view,
yep.
How much of a headache is something like the PDF format to deal with?
It's less of a headache now than it once was because it's a published standard, which means, you know, it makes it easier for us to deal with. Because in the early days of PDFs, it wasn't terribly well documented to external parties. And a lot of people, like, you know, people creating PDF creators, things like QPDF or whatever that allow you to output to a PDF, had to pretty much reverse engineer the format to create it. So for us as an anti-malware company, what it means is a PDF can contain any content whatsoever, pretty much. And you can embed anything into it. And so it might be a transport mechanism for dodgy attachments. It has been. It can, in fact, there was a thing called Peachy back in 2001, where we'd seen that there was a possibility of threats, and that was a self-replicating bit of code that would, if you opened the PDF in Acrobat Creator, it would create a copy of itself and send it out.
Nice.
So, yeah, there's been you know, people looking at the malware potential for PDFs for quite some time, and those are sort of edge proof of concept kind of things, that you could make a self-replicating document in PDF in the same way that you could create a Turing machine in PostScript if you really wanted. But the threat that we're getting now is that applications in general are becoming the mechanism, and PDF's great in that format because everyone uses PDF.
Yeah, and it hasn't. It's not really been focused on until now. And I think, look, I really think that's a good sign because it means, you know, the OS bugs are getting rarer. I mean, they're still there, but they're rare these days, and they take a lot of effort to exploit. And you know, you look at stuff like then you look at your browser vulnerabilities, and again, they're starting to come off the boil a little bit. Even your office, well, actually, I would say office bugs, but it's been pretty pretty buck wild lately. But yeah, no, it's interesting to see stuff like, you know, PDF is one of those commonly used applications that's not necessarily, you know, one of those core Microsoft things. I mean, the guys at Microsoft must be loving it that someone else is getting a hard time.
It's some other focus. And that's the thing. The operating systems have implemented lots of security, like address-based randomization, all of this stuff to try and make it harder. And then you've got applications sitting on top of this, which are network aware, so accessible from the network in some cases, or receiving data or making their own connections out to somewhere else. And they're ubiquitous. And I just having a look at, now it's funny, it's not just Acrobat Reader that suffers this. I mean, they've got the JavaScript problem, and I'd say that there might need to be, because I just look and there's an update on Security Focus for yet another, well, a previous JavaScript boundary condition, which has been updated to say it's, you know, now a bit worse. But if you have a look at, there was a recent XPDF issue, the JBIG2 processing library, that's the image compression format, which is an open standard or open source anyway, can be used by lots of people. And there was a boundary condition or multiple security vulnerabilities in JBIG2 library, which affected Acrobat Reader, but it also affected XPDF. And looking at I've just printed out the list of, what is it, vulnerable operating systems, and the list is actually 4 pages of A4 long.
Yeah.
So PDF is that great vehicle for going anywhere you want to go.
Mm-mm. Well, at least it is actually an open standard. I remember interviewing the founder of Sophos in around 2003 when I was working at ZDNet, or ZDNet for our American friends.
Yep.
And, you know, he'd explained to me that you guys had to reverse engineer Microsoft's .doc binary format because Microsoft wouldn't cough it up. They said, oh, it's our intellectual property. We've got to protect it. So, yeah, at least PDF, you can actually go to the standard and, you know.
You can now. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so you can look at something. The problem is that PDF is, like Word documents, quite forgiving. The stuff that we would look at, and our engine dismantles the PDF stream and recurses down layers and layers and layers deep if necessary to get all the stuff. So you can extract the JavaScript stream because it's a separate container. But the internal data encoding can wrap anything, and then you have to pull that apart and go, can that have some more containers? And they're compressed. So it can take a lot of power to process a PDF, but you can refer to the standards. And other people may not refer to the standards. So if you look at a PDF and you go, well, that's obviously corrupt, the reader may be forgiving enough to put it back together,
a la
Outlook and Broken Mime.
Okay, Sean Richmond, thanks a lot for sharing your PDF expertise with us here on Risky Business, mate.
Excellent, thanks.
Sean Richmond on the line from Sydney there in this week's sponsor interview. Thank you again to Sophos for paying the bills. And don't forget, if you have any feedback on this week's show, call Sydney 02-8569 1835 or USA 877-688-8417, and that's a toll-free number. Leave a message and we may play your feedback in next week's show. Oh, and before I go, I should mention we've started up an events calendar on risky.biz. If we've missed something, please email events@risky.biz to have it included. And we also have some sponsorship slots available from July. So if your company is interested, please email sponsorships@risky.biz. And that's it for this week's show. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. Limited.